There's a term in cybersecurity circles called kinetic effects. It basically means doing something in cyberspace in order to cause or provoke an effect in the real world. Usually, this means trying to sabotage machinery or some other physical system that relies on computer software.
For the past several years, though, Russia has been experimenting with kinetic effects in a novel way. They've been using disinformation to try to produce kinetic effects in our political system, to try to affect not machines, but us and our behavior.
And I promise you that I will not let you down. We will do a great job. We will do a great job.
The fact that we're sitting here wondering about whether propaganda works in 2019 because now it's being done on social media instead of in the newspaper or instead of on the radio is like, that's just so confusing to me.
Sure.
Did it swing the election? I have no idea.
We'll never know. Yeah.
But the fact that this happened, the fact that they did it, is absolutely 100% incontrovertible. It is fact.
If the Russians were able to produce a kinetic effect, how exactly were they able to do it? Turns out it took some trial and error before they finally started getting some real-world results. And along the way, maybe changed the course of history.
This is Raw Data, a podcast about how information becomes power. I'm Andrea Mustaine.
And I'm Mike Osborne. This is the second in our series about Russian efforts to spread disinformation and to mess with our political process.
In the last episode, we looked at the history of Russian disinformation. It goes back to Soviet times. But now, under Vladimir Putin, disinformation has gone digital. Today, we're going to get into the particulars of all that. Because it turns out that the Russians spent several years tinkering around, basically experimenting with digital disinformation way before the 2016 election.
We're going to look at some of those digital disinformation experiments. We're going to start with something that happened almost 5 years ago.
September 11th, 2014, there's an explosion at a chemical factory in St. Mary's Parish, Louisiana.
September 11th, 2014, all of a sudden, these accounts start posting about an explosion at a chemical plant in Louisiana with photos of smoke rising from this building.
This is Renee DiResta. She studies disinformation, and she was a lead researcher on a report for a Senate investigation into the 2016 election. She told us about this event at the Columbia Chemicals plant.
Video is soon posted on YouTube. Twitter is flooded with chatter, including screenshots of news websites.
So they have these fake news sites, these websites that they've made, URLs that are slight deviations from, I think, CNN. It was cnn.something.com instead of just cnn.com.
Here's CNN's.
So it's 2014, the anniversary of 9/11. And the story was spreading online.
And local residents received text messages warning them of toxic fumes in the area.
Pretty soon, there was a fake Wikipedia page, then a fake Facebook page.
Then a video was uploaded to YouTube.
They start saying that the toxic smoke is killing horses. And there's a collection of photos of dead horses. And so they're using these hashtags, Columbian Chemicals, and then I think the hashtag was actually dead horses.
And in fact, the same video of the burning building on YouTube also showed masked terrorists claiming responsibility.
So it wasn't just a hoax about a chemical plant exploding. It's that they're trying to create the perception that America is under attack.
So videos, websites dressed up to look like CNN, text messages to local residents, dead horses. And all of this was happening on the anniversary of 9/11. This was well planned out.
Ultimately, who was behind this?
It was the Internet Research Agency.
It was all the work of the Internet Research Agency, a shadowy Russian organization based in a nondescript building in St. Petersburg.
The Internet Research Agency, or IRA, is a Russian company that's been running influence operations since 2013. They pump out fake news, memes, and propaganda on behalf of the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin.
The Columbia Chemicals hoax was a kind of test. Poke the system, try a bunch of stuff, and see if you can identify vulnerabilities. The cyber folks call this a penetration test, or just pen test.
Can we make this go viral? Can we make this trend? Can we generate a real-world response?
And in at least one way, they did get a real-world response. People were really freaked out.
You know, you're saying, like, this is what I'm seeing on social media. My eyes are telling me one thing. These purported eyewitness accounts are posting these things. And then you have the government trying to figure out what the hell is going on. You have the chemical plant releasing a statement saying, we have no idea what's happening. There has been no, there's no toxic gas.
No dead horses.
No dead horses.
In the end, the authorities caught onto the hoax fairly quickly and set about reassuring the public. The IRA, this Kremlin-backed troll farm, was only able to wreak so much havoc. But this wasn't the IRA's first attempt to manufacture a crisis, and it was certainly not their last.
I've done analysis on all the tweets from the IRA, and I would say that that was one of several attempts to try to create false crisis events.
This is Kate Starbird. She's a professor in the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering at the University of Washington. Like Renee DiResta, she studies online disinformation.
If you look at some of their tactics and how they changed, for the IRA Twitter accounts, you see between 2013 and 14 and even maybe into 15, this is something they tried like 5 or 6, maybe even 7 or 8 times.
At one point in 2015, they tried to spread a made-up story about poisoned turkeys around Thanksgiving. Point is, Kate Starbird says the IRA has been at this for a while.
But she kind of backed into studying all this IRA stuff by accident, all because of a somewhat new disinformation tactic that the IRA started to embrace just a few years ago, taking real-world arguments and amplifying them into bitter, polarizing conflicts.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
Because why make up a crisis when you can just pour gasoline on a smoldering one?
Initially, when we looked at the Black Lives Matter conversation, we were just looking at how it was organized, what are people talking about on Twitter.
Before the 2016 election, Kate Starbird, probably like most people, wasn't really thinking about Russian disinformation. Her main area of research is in something called crisis informatics. Basically, how people organize online during natural and man-made disasters.
But she had a student who was interested in studying a social crisis. The student wanted to study Black Lives Matter and the online response to police shootings. So Kate said, sure, not our usual focus, but that sounds like a worthy project. So they got to work collecting data. They basically pulled a bunch of conversations and hashtags from Twitter.
At first, the Black Lives Matter project was all about understanding the shape of online conversations. Who was talking about the issue? And how were different political groups trying to frame debates about police shootings? And when Kate and her group mapped it out, what they saw was
essentially just polarization in the information space. So you can look at it through retweet trajectories. You can look at it through like properties of the audiences, but you actually see these very two different spheres of the conversation.
So maybe not so surprising. They wrote up a paper about their findings, which came out in late 2017.
And about 2 weeks after we published it, Twitter released a list of accounts that they had identified were associated with the Internet Research Agency in Russia. And I instantly recognized some of the accounts that were in that list as accounts that had been in our study of Black Lives Matter.
In other words, totally unbeknownst to Kate, the Russians had been all over this conversation on Twitter.
We had featured some of the Internet Research Agency's accounts in the paper. In the text of the paper, we had about 20 examples.
What is this world coming to when you can't aim a gun at some cops without them shooting you? Hashtag Black Lives Matter.
We had picked them because some of the examples were particularly vitriolic.
Nothing says Black Lives Matter like mass looting convenience stores and shooting people over the death of an armed thug.
Yeah, so I saw those accounts, I'm reading through, and I'm like, holy moly. It was a surprise and unsettling.
So the Russian accounts were spewing some pretty hateful stuff. And that hateful stuff was getting a lot of play on Twitter. In other words, the IRA was both inflammatory and influential. But this Russian tweeting wasn't just happening on the right. It was also happening on the left.
Cops called elderly black man the N-word before shooting him to death. Hashtag killer cops. Hashtag Black Lives Matter.
The IRA agents were on both sides of the conversation, but they weren't doing the same things on both sides of the conversation. And in some ways, they were contradictory. Like on the left, they were saying very sort of vitriolic things against police. And on the political right, they were anti-Black Lives Matter and actually saying things that were, in some cases, just outright racist. And so we could see them kind of dividing and aggravating and just playing off of the divisions that are already in our society.
So step one, infiltrate a political movement. Step two, get involved on both sides of the conversation. Tweet things, say things, spew hate, and see if you can get the two sides even more pissed off at each other.
They target organic activism, they infiltrate it, and once inside of it, they shape it towards their goals.
Now the trick is to converge, to bend the two groups in the same direction and achieve an outcome, a kinetic effect.
On the political right, they were very supportive of Donald Trump, and we knew that. On the political left, they were anti-Hillary. They were saying, you know, don't vote for Hillary. She doesn't really represent us. Stay home. Vote for Jill Stein. They would say that Hillary Clinton is a racist. And so they converged in support of Donald Trump and denigration of Hillary Clinton, even though they were opposing in their voices in terms of the Black Lives Matter conversation.
And this was the kinetic effect they were going for. Excite Donald Trump's voter base and try to suppress African-American voter turnout.
There was another point of convergence, another goal the Russians wanted to accomplish now that they had inserted themselves into this conversation.
On both sides, they criticized what they called the mainstream media, encouraging people to seek out independent media and alternative media.
And this is part of their big picture strategy, the long game. And it's pretty simple. Confuse the public at every opportunity. Sow doubt. Pump out fake news, spin, propagandize.
Build a world where no one knows where to go for reliable information. A world where there is no truth. And another way to do that? Spread conspiracy theories.
Russia, Soviet Union has often used conspiracy theories as a vector for disinformation. This is what they do. This is how they work. They're really trying to basically hack reality.
Kate had a front row seat to the rise of conspiracy theories on social media. And between 2013 and 2016, her researchers noticed that there was one flavor of conspiracy theory that kept popping up.
Crisis actors rumor that it didn't happen. It was staged. It's a hoax event.
There's a conspiracy theory out there that some of the shooting events, like Sandy Hook and the Orlando nightclub shootings, never happened. That these are hoaxes meant to influence gun debates. The people who buy into this conspiracy claim that there are no real victims, only crisis actors, people brought in to stage everything.
So in 2015, one of Kate's PhD students collected data on crisis actors and false flag hashtags. And then he created a network map to see where all the conspiracies were coming from.
They showed a lot of links to websites that were just things that we'd never heard of. So they had a lot of links to weird sites. And then the structure of the different relationships of following, it was so weird. I was like, this doesn't even make sense. It had like these pro-Trumpers were there. This is late 2015. And then they were connected to these white supremacists in Europe. And then this group talking about Brexit. We didn't even know what Brexit was yet in the U.S., right? Because it hadn't been voted on and it was kind of not even on our radar. And then in the middle was this sort of anonymous WikiLeaks group. And I was like, why is WikiLeaks and anonymous sitting between, you know, Brexit and the white supremacists on our graph and kind of intermingled with this huge pro-Trump group?
Seriously, back in 2015, you're looking at this.
Yeah, so in our data, we're like, what is going on here? And that turns out that there's this intersection of these conspiracy theories, this disinformation, and this rise of global populism. And we could see it in our data starting around 2015.
All of these efforts were part of a bigger effort to weaponize information and social media. Whether it's manufacturing a crisis, infiltrating a grassroots political movement, or spreading conspiracies, the point was to co-opt different sources of information, destroy trust in institutions, and really change people's behavior to create a kinetic effect.
But disinformation techniques are changing. The technology keeps advancing. And if the Russians or anyone else want to mess with our democracy again, it's probably not going to go down exactly the same way it did in 2016.
So we want to make sure that we're not focusing our attention disproportionately on last year's war.
Renee DiResta again.
And are thinking more proactively about what is coming.
Because what's coming will probably be different and may be more effective and more powerful than what's come before. The Russians have learned a lot from their years of experimentation. Something like the Columbia Chemicals hoax could look way different in 2020.
One example, deep fakes. Fake videos where images are fabricated, kind of like Photoshop in motion.
If this was done with a deep fake of, you know, a president, for example, confirming that ISIS had attacked us, right? Mm-hmm. What would have happened then? You know, there's where we are in 2019 with differences in technology makes the potential of, you know, looking back at Columbia Chemicals feel like a far more sinister first attempt.
In an environment where conspiracy theories go viral, it's easy to imagine a manufactured crisis taking root, inciting panic in the streets. Or who knows, maybe a hoax would serve a totally different purpose as a distraction from other more important events happening somewhere else. What's the one thing you want people to know about disinformation?
This is such a hard one, but I think the most important thing is not that we become cynics or skeptics to the nth degree. I think the most important thing is for us to start identifying whom we can trust rather than backing away and stop trusting everybody.
The answer I thought you were going to give is that we are all vulnerable, that none of us are immune from disinformation.
Yeah, and I've been saying that a lot, and I hate to leave people with that because I think that that almost feeds into the goals of disinformation, which are to have us back away, to have us not know that we can trust information and back away from the political sphere, get back on our heels, and the a society that doesn't know where it can go for trusted information is a society that's easily controlled. It's more important for us to find people and sources and voices that we can trust than for us to stop trusting everything.
Of course, disinformation is not just an American problem. It is global.
Next time, the final episode in our series on Russian disinformation. We'll explore how the loss of trust is related to the rise of authoritarians around the world.
You've been listening to Raw Data from PRX. This episode was reported by Mike Osborne and written by both of us.
Catherine Fenollosa is the episode producer. Curtis Fox is our editor. Ian Koss is our sound designer. Our theme music is by Michael Linder at Hat Pineapple Productions.
Additional support from John Barth, Genevieve Sponsler, and Ray Pang.
Raw Data is supported by the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, whose mission is to produce interdisciplinary research on critical global issues. Learn more about their research and upcoming events at fsi.stanford.edu.
Funding for Raw Data is provided by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. I'm Andrea Mustaine.
And I'm Mike Osborne. Thanks for listening.
You know, you say research and I say research.
I know.
Is that bad?
I don't think so. I think it's fine.
You say research and I
yeah.
say research.
I think that's the song. I don't think that's how that song goes.
From PRX.